Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman on the show till 11 o'clock tonight. This week is the Chicago International Music and Movies Festival. SimFest starts Wednesday night and goes through the weekend. One film that will be featured on opening night is the Midwest premiere of The Smart Studio Story. This is the critically acclaimed documentary that features the Madison, Wisconsin music studio run by Butch Vig and Steve Marker. They produced hundreds of records and were the only studios in America that were churning out college and alternative rock albums in the 1990s. It seems like every alternative band at the time recorded up at 1254 East Washington in Madison, Wisconsin. Of course, Butch Vig worked on some of the biggest albums of all time, the Smashing Pumpkins' Gish and Siamese Dream, Sonic Youth's Dirty, and Nirvana's Nevermind. Add L7, House of Pain, Urge Overkill, Soul Asylum, The Foo Fighters, and so many more bands of record to that list that it makes your head spin. When it comes to rock and roll, producer and musician Butch Vig is a household name. Currently, he produces and plays drum for the band Garbage, which has a new album, Strange Little Birds, which is slated for an early June release. Butch Vig will be at the premiere at SimFest of The Smart Studio Story, and he joins me now. Mr. Vig, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Justin.
It's great to have you on the show. It means a lot to us. The documentary is great, and it really showcases what you guys did, that DIY experience. You know, you say in the film, there wasn't a lot of money or there wasn't a lot of attention from the coast at that time, so it gave you guys sort of the freedom to do it your own way.
Totally. I mean, a lot of the background of the film is sort of how the studio got started, and Steve and I totally did DIY. We had no formal training. We had no money, really. We just wanted to build a little clubhouse recording space that we could hang out and invite our friends and bands in to record, and that's what we did. And much like the story of the studio, the Smart Studio Story of the film was kind of put together that way, too. Wendy Schneider is the director, and it took her about 6 years. A lot of that time was trying to track down content, but she's made the film very, very much like Smart, very guerrilla style, very DIY, and you can see that in just the way the film is. There's a really cool energy to it, and a bit of a funky lo-fi quality here and there, but it's meant to be that way. It's very much in the spirit of the studio.
Yeah, and it's got a great, I mean, a lot of the transitions, you have the posters and all the different record covers and album covers of the time. It's really great. It's almost like a memory lane kind of, and a lot of great footage of at the time of you guys. A lot of what Smart Studios was trying to figure out how to make a record. You talk about it in there that you didn't follow, like there wasn't sort of, this is how you do it. You know, you guys kind of made your way trying to figure out what an album was supposed to sound like.
Yeah, when I started, I didn't know what I was doing. And so it was an experiment for me, and I got to experiment on the bands, plus they got to experiment using me trying to figure out how to make them sound good. So it was a learning curve for everyone involved, especially the very early years when we moved into the Gisho building, which was the space before we moved into 1254. Mm-hmm. It was just a funky warehouse, and I felt like we were lab rats. You know, we'd bring in bands and go, well, we don't have very much gear. What can we do to make it sound interesting? So, and then the bands were always up for it. You know, none of them really knew what a proper recording studio was or how a record should sound. They just wanted to come in and bring a six-pack of beer and try to record some punk rock. So
right.
That's what we did.
Do you think that helped you? I mean, further down the road, you know, you talk about in the film about your style, about slicing and dicing and splicing together tracks and moving things around. But did it help you that you were experimenting in those early days with some of the major records that you did later in your career?
Yeah, I mean, it was a great stomping ground for me to sort of figure out how to make albums, just working with bands like Tar Babies and Killdozer and Die Kreuzen. We didn't have world-class gear, so we had to figure out ways to make things sound good. And I think the one thing that's rubbed off on me after all these years is I don't really feel elitist. Like, I don't have to go into a world-class studio and have Neumann microphones. And Oh, I like Neumann microphones, don't get me wrong. But I don't have to have any of that. I learned how to make records very guerrilla style. And to this day, even in the new Garbage record, we did a lot of it very guerrilla style. You know, if there's a mic close to an amp, that's good enough. Let's record it. You know, I can sometimes get very meticulous with the recording and arranging and mixing, but a lot of the time I just like to go kind of by the seat of my pants, and that's kind of what I learned at Smart Studios.
Does that become harder for you when you become Butch Vig and everybody comes in and you're like, let's go seat of the pants? The people are like,
well, it's, you know, I think anybody who works with me knows I just kind of go with the flow. One of the things that I learned early on about bands is they're unpredictable, and sometimes those U-turns you get are left field curves in the studio are what make tracks sound exciting. So anytime I start a record, in my head I kind of get an idea where it's going to go and what it's going to sound like, but it's always different. And I think that's one of the reasons I like to go back and keep doing it so much, is that it's completely unpredictable.
Well, in the film, the guys from Killdozer say you were kind of like a member of the band. Is that the idea as a producer when you're producing a record, to become a member of the band?
Well, I'm usually pretty low-key in the studio, and I guess the whole point that I'm trying to get with a band is I want them to relax and just even forget that I'm there. You know, I don't want them to be self-conscious or nervous, and I'm used to being in a studio all the time. But sometimes, especially young bands, as soon as they get in there, they tighten up a little bit, or they can, especially when they perceive, okay, this is the take. We're going for it now. Don't screw it up. And so my part of my job as a producer is just to get them to relax. And so I think I've gotten really close with the artists I've worked with over the years. You know, I consider a lot of them my friends to this day that I've worked with. And I think part of that is maybe just my Midwest Scandinavian heritage, that sort of quiet, stoic nature. I'm not really sure, but it to me, making records is 50% psychology. It's 50% is the song and the arrangement and getting great performances, but I have to figure out how to get into a band's head and into their psyche and to figure out what makes them tick and how to get them to relax and get great performances.
You know, halfway through this movie, you know, we get to the point where you guys are, you know, breaking, where the Smashing Pumpkins are there, you were involved in Nevermind, Nirvana, and the world changes. I mean, 1254 East Washington becomes an address that everybody in rock and roll knows. Take us back to that moment. Where was it where you realized that you were going from Butch Vig, the guy who's going to the bar next door to just get guys to sing, to, you know, Butch Vig of Smart Studios?
Well, when I finished Nevermind, I had a barbecue in my backyard. I was renting an apartment on the lake in Madison, and actually the Smashing Pumpkins were in town. We were finishing some B-sides. And I think it was around the 4th of July, and we just invited people over to have some beer and brats. And I remember putting the record on a boombox, Nevermind, I'm just putting it on a picnic table, and everybody sort of gathered around, and no one talked for like 45 minutes or whatever. They just listened to the whole album. And it was done. No one said anything for about 20 seconds, and someone said, play it again. And so I just played it again. I remember I got sort of nervous, just like, wow, this is really intense, man. Everybody's really, really focusing on this. And then I had a couple of people and say, this is going to change your life. And at that point, we'd been playing the record for people, like some of the marketing people at Geffen. I think they've been playing it for some of the radio promo people and things. And everyone just thought it was great. But, you know, we just thought, oh, great, maybe it'll get some airplay in the radio. And you know, maybe we'll have a gold record someday, possibly. And then it just completely blew all that out of the water. You know, it just it really changed my life, and anybody closely involved, it changed their life. It was shortly after that, too. I was also working with the Pumpkins, and I was working with Billy in the day the record went number one, and that was like, I couldn't even really believe that.
Wow.
But it was cool. It was a very cool moment.
For
changed
you,
my life.
I mean, obviously, I mean, at that point on, it changed your life because you're involved with one of the best records of all time. You know, it became the documentary talks about Smart Studios becoming Ground Zero, that every band wanted to come in and record with you. They wanted to come in. They wanted to capture that magic. What was it like after that? I mean, obviously, you said your life changed. Was that a big part of it, that everybody was looking for you?
Well, Nevermind gave me the opportunity to kind of pick and choose projects. And I stayed in Madison. I had offers to set up a studio in London and New York and Los Angeles. Labels were calling me to come on board as a staff producer. But I just felt comfortable in staying grounded in Madison. And it was good because the phone rang off the hook, and we had tons of projects, not just for me, but other bands that wanted to come there. So Steve got busy, more busy producing, and Mr. Colson, one of the engineers there, started getting tons of work. And we had a lot of freelance engineers who came in and worked at Smart. So it was really good for the studio, just in terms of our business. But it became sort of annoying to me because people thought I had some magic button I could push and turn them into an alternative superstar grunge band. And some of the music I got sent was totally inappropriate, like folk singers or blues guitarists that were trying to go grunge. And it was, you know, it's like anytime something's successful in the music biz, everybody sort of chases it for a while. And luckily that didn't last too long. I like I said, it was great for the studio, and Steve and I never had any business sense at all. So just to have that kind of word of mouth, really, you know, well, this is where we got to go. You know, Butch is from Smart Studios. Let's try to go record there. So it was really good. It gave not just me, but a lot of the other people on our staff a lot of great work back then.
In the documentary, Billy Corgan says that, you know, he kind of wished for the 1254 East Washington before you guys changed it up, before it became bigger and cleaner and everything about it. And you even mentioned in one of the spots just about kind of, you know, when you got bigger, you kind of lost the vibe. Talk about that.
Well, the first incarnation at 1254 was, again, very DIY. We did a lot of the carpentry work and acoustic work. You know, we didn't hire a consultant and an acoustician. And so, I read through some books, and we sort of knew we don't want parallel walls, and we need to put up this kind of soundproofing and stuff. But the drum room there was really, really intense. Yeah, one of the most intense drum rooms I've ever recorded in, and not just here, but all over the world. And it was haphazard how we lucked into it. The problem was it kind of had one sound. Like if a jazz band came in, you were trying to get a nice even tone. Well, you got this pretty intense, really insane drum sound. So a lot of times we would have to baffle the drums down and move the guitar amps out into the hallway, or you know, put them upstairs and stuff to try and sort of get better separation. But if you were going for a really intense punk rock sound or just a rock and roll sound, that it was the perfect room. Then when we remodeled, I wanted to make control rooms that were more spacious and more accurate. So that became kind of the focal point, and we deadened down the live room. We changed the design on it so it was more even sonically. You know, you could put more people in there, and the decay time was a little bit more controllable. So it wasn't as vibey. It was more probably useful and you know, overall in a lot of different ways. But we did lose some of that crazy sound that we had from the very get-go. At the time, though, it was an okay trade-off for me because I was just starting Garbage, and so much of Garbage was about, you know, lab rat experiments in the control room where we would be taking sound and running them through samplers and manipulating them and running them back through stomp boxes and stuff. So a lot of time sitting behind the console, you know, doing weird experiments. And that's so in some ways it was good that we did it.
And that seemed to be, you know, with Garbage and talking about the DIY start of Smart Studios, that seems to be your calling card. The ability to continually evolve and be able to experiment with your recordings and producing. Has that changed at all for you based on the advent that anybody can pick up a Pro Tools or a sound editing system? I mean, obviously what you were doing at Smart Studios in the 80s, you know, people are doing on their computers or laptops in their house now. Have you evolved with the technology, or do you continually stay with what brought you to the dance?
You know, I have evolved with the technology. I love using digital DAW systems. I love Pro Tools and all the amazing plugins, both the, like soft synths and just, you know, how you can manipulate sound. But I still love analog, old school manipulation of sound too. I love stomp boxes. You know, I love running things through racks, through EQs and compressors, especially funky ones, not necessarily state-of-the-art ones. You know, sometimes you find cheap gear at rummage sales, or you go on eBay and you go, I don't know what this is, but it's only $25. Let's get it and see if it works. And a lot of times it's hit or miss, but every now and then we stumble onto things that just have really interesting sounds. And we used a lot of stomp boxes and analog synths on the new Garbage record. There's quite a lot of there's a bit of lab rat experimenting going on the album, and I think it's we made a kind of a more of a sort of cinematic atmospheric record. There's at least a lot of the songs have less guitars on them and more kind of really interesting sonic texture. So it was really fun to make. And yeah, so I'm kind of old school but kind of new school, I guess.
Well, the new record is called Strange Little Birds. It's slated for an early June release. That's the band Garbage at SimFest on Wednesday, the Midwest premiere of the Smart Studio story about the Madison, Wisconsin music studio run by Butch Vig and Steve Marker. Butch, you're going to be there on Wednesday. Thank you so much for taking some time out to talk to us about the documentary, about your career, and about the new record.
Cool. Well, thank you, Justin. And we hope to see you all at SimFest.